drinking, it is as if they had never stopped. They pick up either immediately where they were, or even worse, where they would be had they continued drinking through the entire period of time. And so there's an absolute need to keep in touch spiritually. And therefore, we have the first of what I hope everybody would agree are the maintenance steps of our program. This is purely the next day. Well, the whole thing is my own opinion, but some things are more out on a limb than others. I believe the time when it becomes essential to start working the 10th step is immediately after 5, 6, and 7. The Big Book recommends that following our 5th step, if possible, we spend an hour in silence, and during that period of time, we see if we're ready to start for the first time becoming entirely ready to have God remove our defects, and then follow this up with the 7th step, praying, humbly asking that he will remove our defects. 8 and 9, for many of us, writing the list and working our amends, takes a period of time. I believe through that period of time, we can already start doing things that will open us up to new troubles and new difficulties. And so it's just my own opinion that the time to start a daily inventory is immediately, well, I would say, the day after we finish our 5th step. We will, as we work the later steps, see the inventory in an entirely different light. Each step, I believe, can only be really understood and worked completely when it follows the step previous to it. So while we can do 10 before 8 and 9, until we're fairly well through our inventory, we won't really understand everything that the 10th step involves for us. I've just seen too many people get drunk with long-term sobriety. And if it can happen to them, I've got to believe that it can happen to me. That's learning by taking the inventories of others. And so I find that if it can happen to them and has happened to them, that's one good reason why I've got to kind of all the time keep sort of my finger on my own, the pulse of my own life. The Big Book says that continued spiritual growth, and I'm not quoting it, I'm paraphrasing it here. Our sobriety is contingent upon our continued spiritual growth. That's closer to a quote, but it still isn't the exact words. So I've got to keep checking myself to see if I'm growing spiritually. When I was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous about a year and a half, I went down to Dallas, and I met a gal, a young drug addict, red hair. She's really neat. She has done more than anyone else to help me grow spiritually. The greatest way she did it was a little bit, a very, very shocking thing that I won't get into today, but I've been able to use to help a lot of other people. One of the other things she did that helped my program a lot was she told me she did a written inventory. She said, when I did my 4th step, I discovered a new ability to be honest on paper. I found out how I could lie to myself in my mind, and when I put myself on paper, it made all the difference in the world. And I figured, gee, isn't that great? It's the only way it should be done, because I had had that experience. I got to write a daily inventory. 3 months later, since I believe in great speed in this program, I wrote my first inventory. For about the next year and a half, I would write 15 out of every 30 days at most. Lately, however, I write probably 5 out of every 7 days. I believe, and I know most people in AA are not going to agree with the two things I'm going to share with you, but I believe that when Bill Wilson used a word twice in the 12 steps, he probably intended it to have the same meaning. That he didn't want it to mean one thing once and another thing the second time. And the interesting thing is that when he first used the word inventory in the Big Book, the expansion of the steps, where the steps were first really offered in a full form, it's clear that inventory is to be done in writing. As someone told me, as I shared with you, 9 times the 4th step refers to a written inventory. When he uses that exact same word, and not something like an examination of self or a self-examination, when he uses the exact word inventory in the 10th step, to me it seems logical that he's using the word with the same meaning that he had in the 4th step. and that therefore the inventory probably should be in writing. I believe this, I do this, and I find it tremendous. I don't like doing it. I don't like doing any of the steps. Chuck Lawrence, a man who died sober of alcoholism in 74, I believe, who I had the pleasure of hearing, came down to Lawton where I was, and he said, if anyone tells you they like working the steps, they either don't understand the steps or they're lying. Because every single step goes against the nature of every person, especially against the nature of an alcoholic. Because every single step has as its purpose, as the 12 and 12 points out, bringing greater humility into our lives. Now, we are not people who enjoy humility. Oh, come on, make me more humble. I love it, I love it. No way. You know, I don't like surrendering. I don't like having to believe in someone else. I don't like putting my slop on paper. I don't like sharing it with someone else. I don't like trying to love the parts of me I don't love. I don't like making a list of people I've hurt. I don't like going up to them and making amends. And I hate daily inventory. The longer I write my daily inventory, the more I hate doing it. But I love how I feel the next day. And so I do it. It, to me, is certainly one of the three most important steps in my whole program, writing a daily inventory. I'd like to share this with you in just a moment. Before that, I'd like to get into the second thing. So the first thing where I differ from a lot of people is I believe the daily inventory should be in writing. Secondly, most people that I know really have changed the step. They say, and when we are wrong, promptly amended it. They boast how when they examine themselves and they become aware that they've hurt someone, they immediately go to that person and make amends. The word amend exists in the ninth step of our program, and if Bill felt that all we had to do when we saw wrong in our day was apologize for the wrong we had done, I believe he would have used the word that for him meant amends. He didn't. He used the word admit. And the word admit he has used twice before in the program. In the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and I'm not sure that that applies in this case at all. In the fifth step, immediately after the previous inventory step, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I believe that the 10th step says we update periodically our fifth step. We go to another person and we bring up to date exactly what we did in our first fifth step. Just watch it. Step 4, we take an inventory. Bill meant it to be written. Step 5, admit it to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. The word admit and the word wrongs, both in the fifth step. Now we're in the 10th step, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, the same step is, word is in step 5, the only other place as far as I know that that word is used, promptly admitted it. I believe we're supposed to update our inventories. A lot of people don't like that. I believe they've never tried it. Some people do it every 2 or 3 months. I have someone I sponsor who drives down and does it that frequently. I do it every year to 2 years. There is no greater sensation. If you've done your fifth step and you like what you felt when all that garbage was gone and you felt good, and that good feeling isn't as strong anymore, then why don't you go back and redo what brought the peace? I believe if you redo it, if you bring your inventory up to date, if you go to someone and you share it all, I'll tell you, I don't believe you'll get that same peace back. That is not my experience at all. My experience is each time you will get a different, deeper peace back. That's even greater. So I believe in how crucial it is to go back and do it again and again and again. In a joking way, all these people who say you only do one fifth step, I kind of wonder if they only had intercourse once. It was so good that they never did it again. If it's so good, do it again. If the fifth step brought some great peace into your life, do it again. I can't tell you how important I feel. I'm going to try to, though. The 10th step is, for a long time, especially the period when I was in Enid, I would do my praying and my inventorying in the evening. And every so often, something would happen. I'd say about once, at least every 2 weeks, some problem would come up. And I wouldn't be able to get them both done. I'd have to choose between them. And I would feel that any religious person obviously knows how important prayer is, and so I would pray. I did this about a half year to a year, and finally one day, I made the astounding discovery, and discoveries like this come rare in my life, that 10 comes before 11. When I realized that, I realized I was wrong. In the steps, inventorying comes before praying. And if I, through no responsibility of my own, must choose, inventorying is to be chosen before prayer. From that time on, if an emergency comes and I have time either to pray or to inventory, I usually inventory. I can share this from my own experience. When I chose prayer over inventory, the next day was usually screwed up. Every time since I made the decision, when I've chosen prayer over inventory, the next day goes lousy. When I choose inventory over prayer, I sail through the next day with deep, deep peace. So the program is working for me exactly as it was said that it was supposed to. I believe, therefore, that it is crucial that I really take a good, solemn look at my program one day at a time. I also believe it is very important that periodically I clean up my act by going to someone and sharing it. It hurts me to hear newcomers, not when they're first in, but people who don't have that much time in the program pass, feeling that they don't have anything to say. Because I have learned so much from newcomers. There's a guy who, as far as I know, never really made the program. He'd come and make it for 2 months to 6 months. And he still isn't with it. When last I left Alva, one day just said a simple little thing that made the 10 steps so neat. Also, why you have to do a first, fourth, and fifth. He said, you know, if these garbage trucks simply ran around and did nothing but pick up the garbage, compact it and stow it, sooner or later they'd be that heavy that they'd blow their tires. They got to dump the garbage. It's as simple as that. That's what the fifth step is. It's dumping the garbage. Once that garbage is dumped, however, the truck the next day sets out on its routes and it's picking up new garbage. And it's compacting it and stowing it inside. And so periodically it's got to be dumped again. And therefore, I don't want to live with my garbage. I don't want to live with all that stuff. I start hurting people. I start being ashamed of who I am. I start doing things that I don't want to live with. Things that cause me to become secretive. Things that cause me to want to escape. Things that cause me to run from myself. I feel the 10th step is very important because properly done, I believe it leads to the 11th. I'm going to share in a moment the importance of balancing the 10th step. We've got to write the good as well as the bad. When I write my good, when I see that there actually are things happening in my life, it tells me that there's a power greater than me really present in me. At the end of the day, when I can see that someone came with a problem and I didn't like them and I was able to sit down and in love listen to them, I know I couldn't do that. We had it happen just the other night when the gal, if you were here at the start when I read that neat little thing from the gal on her second birthday, someone else at the table, another gal was crying for her birthday. And I thought how wonderful that was. We're so selfish that about the only thing we cried over was spilt booze. And now we get out of our own selfishness and we can shed tears of joy and tears of sorrow for others. I can't cry, but I can feel. I can get choked up almost never over myself, but always over the joy and the sorrow in the lives of others. And that's a nice thing for me to see. It tells me there's another power alive in me. And then when I write the things I've done wrong in the course of a day, that reminds me that while there is a power present in me, there is still me. That same little SOB that I saw on the fourth step is still alive. I'm still as unmanageable, and therefore outside is still lurking alcohol. It's just waiting. I would like to revise the big book. I would like to add two words, and those are the words and patience. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. I don't think it would weaken our program at all to somehow insert those in, and I think it is the universal testimony of AA. It sure is cunning. It sure baffles us. It sure is powerful. And if you just look at people, I remember Clancy once coming back from Akron and sharing sadly that there was someone with 30 years sober in the program who returned to drinking and was dying of alcoholism. This was in Ohio. It's just out there waiting. It'll wait a day and it'll wait a lifetime. It's just out there. So I've got to remember that I'm still me, that I've got all my problems. And both of these pull me into prayer. There's a power present in me. I want to know more about it. I'm still as hopeless, and I need that power all the more. And that, to me, just leads to the 11th step, which is why I believe, once again, for me, when I think it through, that the steps are just placed exactly where they really have got to be. There are, in the 12 and 12, different kinds of inventory mentioned, and they're all important for us. There's the spot inventory. You feel uptight. It's good to check, just to stop a moment and see what's happening. Are you around a certain kind of circumstance, certain kind of situation? It can help you become aware of some of your patterns. There's the daily inventory, and that's the one in the 10th step I speak mostly about. And then they talk about every 2 or 3 weeks you go see your sponsor and bring up him or her up to date with what's happened from the last time. You kind of take an overlook, and then there's an annual or a semi-annual inventory. Some people come to me just with their daily ones, and they'll update from that. And I've done that once when I had to myself. But I prefer, even if I have a good record of daily inventories, not to read them, not to look at them at all, to put them aside, get a sheet of paper, and think of what's happened in the last 2 years. The reason that I can use to illustrate this is buying wallpaper. I once had to buy wallpaper to paper an apartment that I was in Baltimore. I went down, and I'd never, ever had to do anything like this. Got all the samples, looked at them, picked the one I wanted, got ready to go down and say, this is buy the wallpaper, when it occurred to me that I was looking at it from here. And I rarely, through the day, walk around this close to a wall. So I took the wallpaper and I put it on the other side of the room. And I changed my mind immediately. When we do daily inventories, we're just looking at ourselves like this. And sometimes it's good to put our lives at a distance and see what's been happening in the huge sweep. Day by day, I can't be aware of my meeting patterns. Am I throwing in more meetings? I can be aware if I'm missing meetings I should be at. But if I step back and say, okay, in the last 2 years, what's happened to my meeting pattern? Have I liked going to meetings? Have I been going earlier? Have I been going later? Have I been friendlier when I get to a meeting? Have I been more open? Have I been more closed? Have I been more teachable, or have I been more critical? And I can kind of make sweeps and see trends. How was I in the first quarter, or like the first half of that time, the second quarter, the third quarter, the fourth quarter, and I can see how I'm growing. How have I been dealing in my relationships with God? Am I praying more? Am I praying less? Looking at sweeps. And so there's an advantage to also, besides doing a written daily inventory, sitting down, looking at the major areas of our life, looking at the major people in my life. My sponsor, am I calling them more or less? Day by day won't show that. But if I take a semi-annual, annual inventory, something like that, then I'll see the trends and the patterns. And that's really when I can become most aware if I'm growing away from the program. What we need in our daily inventory, what is most important for us, differs by who we are. While we all have the disease of alcoholism, we have different patterns. All Al-Anons are in pattern A. Pattern A fits me and about half the alcoholics I know, I'd say a third to half. We have trouble feeling the good that is in us. It is crucial for us to begin with the good only. When someone with this pattern comes to me to do a fifth step, and I tell them to start writing a daily tenth, I suggest strongly that they spend 30 days writing only good. For the first 30 days, the way I tell them is, I don't care if you rape the Pope, if it's a gal. If it's a guy, I could say the same thing. I don't care if whatever you do, you cannot write it. For the next 30 days, you are not allowed to put on paper one critical thing. You know your faults, but you are blind to reality. And you've got to become honest, not criticizing of yourself in the negative way. You've got to become honest about yourself. And the honesty starts off by saying you're sober, so you're a miracle. Dick said it, it was so neat last night. You go up to your banker and you say, hey, I'm a miracle. Your banker's going to call Ford Supply or Norman or one of those places. Hey, I got one. You got a live one. You got one that went over the fence last night. Walk in AA and tell us you're a miracle. And we know it. Well, of course you are. And if we forget it, it's bad for us. If you forget it, it's bad for you. And if I feel that I'm a failure at the end of the day, something's wrong. Because if I'm sober, God's saying I'm a miracle. And how could you be a failure as a miracle? God is saying by his making me sober that everything I've done negative in that day, he's outbalanced by the positive that he's done, and I've got to learn to see that. The way I do my daily inventory after trial and error, I buy a stenographer's tablet, one of those tablets with a line down the middle, and on the left side I write only the good, and the right side I write only the bad. And I have a rule on days when I'm inventorying proper, they should come out nearly even. Now, whichever is your weakness, some alcoholics, are like that lady who passed gas. They can't see the harm they've done. A lot of people have trouble inventorying. You'll hear them talk about that. People who had no defects until they came into AA and we ruined them. We told them everything that was wrong with them. And they grew a little bit gradually in honesty and came to see the things that were indeed wrong with them. Those people must start out with the wrong that they've done. They've got to learn how to see their faults so that they can open themselves up to God's power in these areas and grow. If your trouble is seeing your good, you've got to force yourself to see the good, and you can't allow, when you've written bad down to that point, you've got to stop, or you'll balance it too much. Yeah. So do the balance. If your trouble is seeing the wrong that you've done, write your wrong, and that's only as much as you can see your good. Now, good could be, supposing you beat your wife 7 times yesterday and 3 times today. That's progress. She may not think so, but that is growth. We've got to learn to see growth, because those of us who have this trouble have standards of perfection for ourselves. And if I did everything I could to help 15 people, but was cool in doing it to the 15th, I'm going to say it was all no good. I'm no damn good. And so I have to force myself to see growth. I have to force myself to see the areas where God is improving me. And as I shared with you, Al-Anons, I believe, almost to a point, belong to that first pattern. What the inventory should cover. Our usual tendency is to cover our thinking. And if I could share that, I think that's the least important thing to write. This is just my own impression. I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist, don't have much training, but from my own life and the lives of others, I think 6 out of every 10 thoughts we have are camouflages to trick us into accepting bad actions. Good reasons for lousy actions. Every lousy thing I've done, just about, I've had a good reason for. And so my reasons will trick me. They're the least important. The question asked two things, and those are the two things I believe should be inventoried, both of them. Actions and feelings. Pause a moment. The easiest way to do it, to do the negative, is pause a moment and try to go back in your day and recall the times when you had what I call down feelings, unpleasant feelings. Remember when they happened, and then write about that instance. And write your day in your words, remember. It's for you and you alone. It's not a spiritual diary that they're going to publish when they decide whether they're going to make you a saint in a hurry or stretch it out a few years. It's just for you. I throw mine away every time I update so I don't get into the ego trip of writing literature. I'm saving my life by this. I'm not giving the world a set of letters that can be read in some refectory someday when people come for a retreat. Ain't going to read my stuff, I'll tell you. Those monks would all be hiding their heads in their cowls. Cowls are the whole. He did that? Oh, wow. So I write my feelings open up to when were bad actions and the other ones. When did I really feel neat, feel peace? What was going on? Because I want to repeat those kind of things. I like feeling good. And then secondly, my actions. Just first, write the actions that hurt me, that hurt someone else. Write the things I should not have done that I did do. Write the things that I did do that I should have done and put those down on paper. Then eventually, if you stick at this long enough, you're going to start seeing patterns in your life. This has come so real and so deep for me. I'm going to blend all of my continuing inventorying together. I don't know if I shared this because I've been talking to several groups in a hurry. Did I share with you the growth in my patterns when I discovered, how the difficulty relating with women and then the difficulty relating with my brother? Okay, all of that, I start seeing patterns in acting. And I can be writing for a long time. I can be writing for months, and then suddenly I'll see something. I'm ready to see it now. I've done some spade work. I've, just like the old phrase in AA, if you're praying for potatoes, you better have a hoe in your hand. And if you really want this to come about in your life, so you ought to be doing the work that will bring the results into your life. And if I've been hoeing the garden long enough, God eventually starts bringing forth a harvest and things start happening for me when it's time for me to be ready. The most recent discovery I've had on the 10th step, and boy, this is huge. I was at the Western Club, and they were having a discussion on the 10th step. And, I wish I could have taped the whole thing. It was just fabulous. One of the most, I'd say it certainly was the best discussion by far I've ever heard in the 10th step, one of the best meetings I've ever been at. Everybody was saying things they needed to hear. But it all gelled together, and I finally pulled it all. It was all like everybody was putting building blocks in an arch. The keystone fell into place. When we're wrong, I am rarely deliberately wrong, consciously and evilly wrong dealing with others. Maybe once or twice a month I'll hurt someone. It usually happens to me in teaching. I'll be uptight, don't warn the students about it, and snap at some kid. And I have a rule that I'll make the apology as public as the wrong was. And the kids kind of, I think, respect me for it. I don't like doing it, but I'll go in and apologize the next day. But that isn't often, and it wasn't deliberate anyway. In my life, there is a major area where I'm wrong, and that I've got to admit it. And it's that I don't think I'm any good. I am almost daily wrong in judging myself. I feel that I'm not a miracle, and God has made me a miracle. I feel that I'm not a masterpiece of my Father, and He has made me exactly this kind of masterpiece. So it is important for me to start seeing in my inventory that I am deadly wrong about myself, that I'm almost 180 degrees off, and start admitting it again and again and again. Admitting it to myself in word and in action, trying to do things that will enable me to celebrate who I am, to make myself a far happier and better person. One other area that I believe the 10-step covers, and we'll break just very briefly after this for just a few seconds to refill the coffee cups, is a partial inventory. I touched on this the other day. I want to repeat it again because they're so helpful. If anything has gone wrong in your life, sit down and inventory that area. You're fired from your job. I don't care if it's the first time or the 10th time. Write out that whole job, but if you have a whole pattern of being fired, write it out. You have a fight with your, you know, with your sponsor. You're having trouble with your kids. Sit down and take that kid, or take all of your children, and write the whole pattern. Everything you ever remember doing. Put it all on paper. And then wait till you're all done, and something's going to bubble up. It may not, but you'll at least feel better. Especially with separations and divorce. You know, just if people would just see this, how much better their lives would be. If you're ever counseling, this is thrown in. It has nothing to do with this. It's advice. If you're ever working with an Al-Anon who's divorcing her husband, tell her to nail him to the wall. Okay? It's crucial. Al-Anons, because of their feeling of no worth, will more often than not sail out of a marriage with nothing. They don't feel they deserve anything. I know of one with over 4 children who divorced her husband and didn't take anything. And she always came up with a good reason for it. And I'll sit down. Now, you got to tell them, if they have children, you can do it. You can't punish your children. They're going to need something. If you don't want any of this stuff because it's going to hurt too much, this is their rationalization. Seeing all the furniture in the home and everything will be painful. Well, just take it and sell it. Have an auction and take the money. The money won't hurt. Put it in the bank. Buy new stuff with it. The other way you can usually get to them, if you can reason with them, is this. And this is real. I tell them to get their own lawyer, get the shrewdest divorce lawyer in town, and burn that guy for everything they can. Because if you teach him that he can sail through your life and burn you and walk out scot-free, you're setting him up to burn the next person. He's sick, and he may not know what he's doing, but let me tell you, you're becoming an accessory before the fact to the hurt he's going to do to her. And boy, they don't like that at all. And I believe it's important for them in the long run. See, they owe it to themselves to insist they be treated with dignity. I owe it to God not to let you walk over me. I owe it to God not to crawl. I owe it to God to stand as one of his children. And the inventories have helped me do this. We'll break briefly and then do the 11th step.
This is Ed Ekstrom speaking. I believe this would be a good opportunity to end this side of the cassette and then start in on the other side of the cassette. So please turn the cassette over and do not rewind. Thank you.
Just my opinion. All the guides I've seen for the 5th step are okay with one exception. The Al-Anon guide. It is lousy. I didn't know that till I reached the city and someone did an inventory with me. And I wondered, she said she'd used a guide. And I wondered why her 4th step was so poor. And it was in this instance. And she showed me the guide and I went through it. And it's terrible. The Al-Anon guide basically inventories thoughts. You go through it. I'd say half the question deals with what people think. The one area that, from my own experience, is least important in inventorying. So if you know an Al-Anon who's going to do a 4th step, get him to use anybody else's guide but that Al-Anon guide. It's a nice, looks tremendous. It's a big book. It's a huge thing. It looks like the biggest thing out on inventory. And I mean it. It's negative. It will not help a person see themselves at all. If they follow that, they can be as blind to where they're at as they were before they started. Yes, it's terrible.
It is really bad. I know I can have the Al-Anon General Services down on my back as far as that's concerned, but I'm speaking from deep experience on that. If you go through that and you look, it's going to, half of what it puts the spotlight on is your thoughts. And that's the least important thing. Feelings and actions. Feelings and actions. Your feelings are your problem. If you can force yourself to act, to treat yourself good, how much better things are going to happen down the line. I'd say for many AAs, for all Al-Anons, one of the most important things you have to do is to make amends to yourself every day. We do owe ourselves amends. We're on the group. We do it by the program. If we have a tendency to be down on ourselves, we should do a favor for ourselves every day. If you would just go out and for five, like 10 minutes, you'll sit down and shut off the whole family. You're not going to be a workaholic, a martyr, or anything. You're going to listen to your music. You're going to tell them all to, you know, go jump somewhere. Y'all get out of the house. I want to hear something I want. I'm going to bake what I want. Every meal should have one thing that you like. You're going to do something that makes you happy. You're not going to be there just to make them happy. We need that. We need to make amends to ourselves daily. Not in the whole day and not all day, but one little favor. Why? Because for the Al-Anons, I am a queen's daughter and I deserve to be treated as such. You don't think your way into that, you act your way into it. The whole AA message is you don't think new actions, you don't feel new actions. You act new feelings, and from those new feelings, new thoughts will occur. And so to me, I have just seen so much stupid thinking in AA and Al-Anon, where we come up with bad good thoughts for bad actions, that forget your thoughts. They'll masquerade. Every time I've screwed myself, I've had a good reason for doing it. Just right across the board. Went on to step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. The story that I've got for that, the reading, I think is really neat. On their journey, Jesus entered a village where a woman named Martha welcomed him to her home. She had a sister named Mary who seated herself at the Lord's feet and listened to his words. Martha, who was busy with all the details of hospitality, came in to him and said, "Lord, why are you not concerned that my sister has left me to do the household tasks all alone? Tell her to help me." The Lord said to her in reply, "Martha, Martha, you're anxious and upset about many things. Only one thing's required. Mary has chosen the better portion, and she'll not be deprived of it." Just when I was reading this, I thought y'all ought to read that at least once a month in Al-Anon. Just Martha's the typical Al-Anon, the workaholic, working herself to death, martyring herself, and wanting everybody to know I'm suffering. This is before, when I say this, I'm not, you know, I'm going from the group experience. It's like I can talk about our usual patterns. But there's a much deeper import to this. In Christian circles, many, especially Catholic circles, many people think this story talks about the two ways of life. Contemplative, spending your whole life in prayer. You leave the world, you become a monk, you don't even teach or anything, you just spend it all in prayer. And active, you go out in the world and you work. It doesn't deal with that at all. Not at all. The story's really neat. If you understand that Jesus can be called the bread of life, you can see that there's just a little bit of humor here. Here is Mary, Martha, working herself into a stew, trying to cook a meal to feed the bread of life. Okay? And that's her basic error. And there's Mary just sitting there and letting herself be loved. She's just listening. I believe if you remember that, you can set your whole religious life correct. What is prayer and meditation? Everybody has their own terms. I've got my own understanding. Meditation is listening. Prayer is speaking. Together, they're a dialogue. You enter into a relationship with God. You speak, he speaks. You've got to listen. You've got to speak. for the full dialogue to occur. I believe, however, that for me, and I can find this so clearly from start to end in the scriptures, it begins with God speaking. So for me, meditation is more important. I've got to hear. I've got to hear what God has to say to me. I've got to hear God speak. Now, what's God going to speak? I have a God of love, and he's going to speak love. I don't think, you were in the program, we take all this stuff. You don't understand until you step back a while and get shocked. Bunch of drunks talking about meditating. What a miracle it is that we've got a step, and we talk about it seriously, and we get together every 12 weeks if we have a step study, and we're talking about meditating. Now, so many Christian people don't have time to meditate. Here we are, drunks. Half of us don't go to church, and we try to put time to meditate every day. We don't know what meditation is, and we try to do it, and it works. You don't have to know. You don't never have to have read a book on swimming to know how to swim. You know, just do it. But there are some little suggestions I'd like to point out. Meditating is listening to God. Now, I did not find God by looking up to heaven. I found God by a group of people saying they were powerless over alcohol, so they understood what it was like when I was powerless over alcohol and giving me love. I found God walking into an AA meeting and just being here. I felt him. See, I had no God, and I wouldn't believe in God when I came to AA. I became a priest as an occupational cure for my emptiness. I was raised in a ghetto where priests were the most respected people, and I thought I'd share this respect if I became a priest. Frustrated, you become a priest, you become a frustrated priest. But I had to do it to find it out. And so I didn't believe in God. I had some hopes in AA. Something happened there that never happened before. My psychiatrist tried to give me understanding. It didn't work. I sat down at that table. I came late, sat there, and I felt loved. All right, now when I want to meditate, when I really want to meditate, that's what I do. Right now, think of all of us here. Put yourself in the midst of us, and every single one of us wants something for you. If you're an alcoholic, we want you to be sober. If you're an alcoholic or an Al-Anon, we want you to have serenity. There's a positive wish flowing out of our hearts for you. Feel that. Just stay in the midst of that. Don't try to fill your head with thoughts. Fill your heart with what we want for you. That's a nice thought to stay with. When you leave here and you get out in your car and you sail out in the world, there are going to be people out there who don't want good for you. Going to be people on the road who don't want good for you. They may show it, they may shake it, all that kind of stuff because you're driving too fast or too slow. People at home, people at work, people in your own family are going to drain you. Right now, just open yourself up in your mind. You know, just see yourself sitting in our midst, and every single one of us, from our hearts, is this kind of warmth, love, light, whatever, however you like to picture it, flowing out of us and into you. That's nice. That's AA. That's God. That's all meditating is. For me. Anything that'll help me experience that, I'll do. Sometimes a text will do it. Sometimes a Bible passage. Sometimes I can take a walk in nature. Sometimes I can listen to a particular kind of music. It isn't what I'm doing. It's the goal that I'm after. For me, meditating is listening to God. God is love. Now, not love is a thing. There's a poster I have that says, for me, God is not a thing, a noun. I'm sorry, the poster says, God is not a noun, but a verb, which means God is not a thing, he's an activity. So when we say love, that doesn't mean God is love as a lump. Here's a big lump of love. God is love as a process. He is loving, always loving, love going out and doing, loving. So what is it, if I want to know God, you can get to this in heavy ways. Meditating is thinking about, is being in the experience, going deeper. If God is loving and I want to think about God, I want to think about being loved. That's all. Now, how do I know what love is? I've never seen God. He's never shaken my hand. But I have seen God and he has shaken my hand. If God is loving, because he's loved me and you. And I know how selfish you are. If you're Al-Anon, I know the hurts in your heart that pulled you into yourself. If you're alcoholic, I know the selfishness, because I've lived it myself. And so when you love me, that isn't you, that's God. There is a power bigger than you that has turned you around. You know, just think about it. If put us all together 1 week before the end of our last big drunk, we wouldn't be positively willing good for each other. We'd be strangling each other, raping each other, killing each other, stealing from each other. And that isn't what we want. So when I can put myself in your midst and feel this flowing, I know I'm feeling God. And there isn't anything I need more than that. And I do that again and again. I'll picture any AA group, put myself at the table, and just feel what they want for me. Not all of them want it, because not all of them have opened themselves up to experience God yet. But the group is group. The group is a local, visible sacrament, sign of God. Certainly does. I don't have any doubts about that. You know, I don't have to like you, but you be in trouble, and I'll go any distance to help you. You don't have to like me. When I walked with the difficulties, we had a lot of difficulties in that group in Enid, a lot of different arguments over a long period of time, and I knew a lot of people didn't care for me at all. I still deeply believe that if I called any of them, if they were the only person I could get in touch with today, and I said, you know, I'm sober, but I'm on the verge of taking a drink, please come and help, I believe they'd do it. Now, that's a group that wants something for me. Love isn't just a sweet emotion. Love is this positive force to help me. And that's a neat feeling. How can you get too much of it? I can't. And so I love to meditate. I've got to start with that. You use the big book, and use anything as I shared, if it's going to help you experience this love. I'm going to jump ahead a moment and say, I really believe most Christians have not found God. I believe most alcoholics have, and it hurts me. You know, I go into church and I'm celebrating Mass, and I look at the emptiness, and then I come with alcoholics and I see the smile. And I just want to get these people. I read that letter that we started the retreat with to the nuns, because half my nuns, at least, don't have any God experience. I see emptiness all over their lives and all over their faces, and they don't know what they're missing. And I'd like to hold them down here. And I'll go on to this. One of the reasons, one of my seniors asked me this, and they're a little frustrated. They said, do we have to become alcoholic to find God? And I think God gave me an answer on the spot. I said, no, of course not. But if you're standing, walking through life, getting down on your knees to pray takes tremendous humility. If you're flat on your ass in the gutter, getting up on your knees to pray is very easy. And that's why we find God. You know, it's just so neat coming up. It's always hard to go down. And that's also one of the lessons of being sober. Sometimes we're sober so well, we're standing so tall, we forget how to needle. And sometimes then we have to be knocked back on our butt to be able to find our knees anew. I feel most Christians have not found God because they're looking for too much. And that's in the Bible. The man Elijah was told he was going to have an experience of God, so God takes him up on a mountain, and an earthquake comes by. And he's told God wasn't in the earthquake. A roaring wind comes by and God wasn't in the tornado. A mighty fire comes by and God wasn't in the fire. And then he hears a whisper coming by and he's told to hide his face, which means God is present. God doesn't come so huge, he comes so small. People didn't, if you believe Jesus was God, I'll make this aside. People didn't accept Jesus because he didn't look like God, he looked like man. And the reason we find God is because we look for man and we look in each other's eyes and we're open to each other's hearts. And that's where God comes. And please, after you found him here, don't lose us and then try to plug into heaven only. I found God through you. I have a God experience. I have conscious contact with God. And if I'm going to continue to find him, I've got to do my meditating the way I first discovered him. I can't forget you and go direct to him because I don't know who he is. I don't understand God, thank goodness. If I understood God, he'd be my size. And we're all in trouble if God is my size. I've experienced him, I know certain things that are so amazing because almost every single person in AA who's been open, Awana said it in that meeting last night, and it's my own experience, how she had to unlearn everything she was ever taught about religion. I believe that. I believe in Chapter 5 when it said we had to be willing to let go of our old ideas absolutely. The most crucial are our religious ideas. Don't take an experience that works and try to force it into a box of someone else's words. Take this experience and stay with it. Stay with love and have enough trust that the God who brought you to him will lead you to every single belief that he considers important for you. And as I've done this, every belief that I was ever taught, I now understand in deep ways, in new ways. Sometimes I could see where people had the right words, but they didn't understand at all what was involved in them because they were looking for too much. They're looking for a God of tornadoes, and we got a God of whispers. They're looking for a God of the majestic, and we got a God who comes in alcoholics. And that's the way it was. They didn't like Jesus because he was too little. That was the big problem. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? You know, that's the kid who was playing down the block. How can he 12-step me and bring God into my life? And so they turned their back on Jesus. If you believe in the Bible, if you don't, it's still the same thing. Where did you find it? Where'd you get your power? Don't short-circuit it. Start here. Start your meditating. Feel what AA is for you. And go from that and then try to sometime sharpen it. That's what I do. I start with that. That then leads to prayer. Prayer is my talking to God, and this too was said, and I agree with this. Most people still pray. It's so human. A lot of things you want. You got your wants. You got your shopping list. You take it up to God, and you tell him what you need from, you know, his spiritual supermarket today. I don't do that, usually, because my life's unmanageable, and I don't know what the hell to ask for. You know, be careful what you pray for, because you just might get it. I've heard that said. Last year at this time, I was praying to get out of Alva, and I did, and I got to Oklahoma City, and it's half and half. I love the city, but I've never been busier, and I've never had less time for prayer. When I was in Alva, everything was lousy, but I was able to plug into God around the clock, and it was neat. And I don't know when I was better off, when I was lousy praying or when I'm busy doing what I want and don't have time to do the prayer. But I do know, just this... This got to be the classic example. Know this wife swapper who prayed that God would send them someone with his same kind of interests, and God did the next day, and 4 years later she swapped him for someone else, and his heart's broken. And he was so cruise, he was so hurt, saying, how could God do this to me? And I said, what do you mean? God gave you exactly what you prayed for. You wanted someone with your interests, you got someone with your interests. Next time you go to God, maybe you may want to change your prayer. I really don't know what to ask for. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for me. I don't know what God's will is. I want to go back to what we shared in the third step. We don't pray for God's will. We don't try to do God's will in the third step. We're too screwed up to know it. I don't know between two choices. Should I be a priest in Oklahoma City or should I be a priest in Alva? I don't know how to make that choice. Somebody said this last year and it rang a bell for me. I heard it in Enid. I do know now when I'm not doing God's will. Okay? I've sharpened that much. And that's even sharpening. 8 years ago, I didn't know it was God's will not to steal money. Today, I do know it's God's will for me not to shoplift. Ain't no doubt about it at all. There are certain things when I do them that everything comes in, and I know God didn't want me to do that. It doesn't mean I don't do them. About all I can say for me is, God is love. And it took me years to reach that in AA. If God's love, what's his will for me? That I let him be love for me. What does that mean? That I let myself be loved. It's as simple as that. That's all that I pray for. Meditation is putting myself in the presence of love. Prayer is my part. It's, you know, okay, you want to love me? Tell you what, I'll do you a favor today. Go ahead, love me. Make God happy. That's what he most wants. And it's not so hard. Just let yourself, in other ways it really is, it's so difficult to let yourself, not the nice parts of you, God wants to love you. Doesn't want to love the dream person, doesn't want to love the person you think he wants you to be. He wants to love you. Wants to love all of you, to go back to steps 6 and 7. And the power to carry that out. The power to let myself be loved. To pray for that. That's not so easy for me. It might be for you. Just again and again. To wash away all my reservations, to let myself be completely filled with love. And it's only... See, a lot of people think that praying for the knowledge of God's will for them is to come up with a list of things God wants them to do. I have talked about the importance of action, but for me, ultimately, being is more important than doing. I don't care what I be anymore. I don't want to be Pope. I used to dream about it. Don't want to be Bishop. Used to dream about it. I don't want to be pastor. I had my own parish. It's not important. I don't have to do anything in this world anymore. If I have love in my heart, life is good. So the most important thing for me is to be, which means to be loved. And I've discovered that if I have love inside me, whatever I do is neat. You know, I can sweep a floor and I'm doing it with love and somehow people feel it. I can listen to a fifth step and people feel that I'm filled with love and that I'm loving them. I know a woman who's not in our program in another town who spends her whole life working for the church, and behind her is just like a wreckage. Wherever she goes, she whirls through lives and leaves destruction because she doesn't have any love in her life. She's all efficiency, do, 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 and she's just bitter. She's empty. She's petty. She'll cut. She'll snarl. She'll chop apart. When she's doing good to you, she'll let you know how lousy you are because you're not doing good to someone else. And you walk, when she walks out of your life, you feel cheaper than you did when she walked in. So, you know, if God made the universe, he doesn't need me to do anything in the world. There's only one thing God absolutely needs me for. There's one thing God cannot do. He cannot fill me up with love if I say no, because he's made me free.
Okay.
He cannot fill me up with love if I refuse to be loved, because he has made me free. And that's my own experience. If I say I will not be loved, I'm not going to know love. I can block God's love in my life. I've done it. I've done it often. So what does God will for me? He wants me to be loved. What does he need me to do? To let myself be loved. If I do that, everything else is going to happen. God can make mountains. God can heal you. He can heal you without my touching. God knows for you far better what you need than I do. God can come into your life and straighten you out. One thing he can't do, he cannot fill me with love if I say no. That's how tremendously great he's made us. He's made us his equal in that respect. Our freedom makes our relationship with God equal. He says, I want to love you. We are total equal in saying, yes, you can love me, or no, you can't. And he will not force us to be loved. So what's his will? His will is that I be loved. What do I need to do? I got to let myself be loved. And if I do this, it all works. You can sit, you know, you see these people. They're not great speakers. You know, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. And every third word is wrong, you know, and their grammar is terrible, and they mangle the English, and they move hearts wherever they speak. Oh, there's a guy, I want to cuddle him every time he talks. In the Capitol Hill group, he's all over the city. Just a big, lovable bear. Just sober so many years, and he's filled with love, and he just wants you to have, every time he opens his mouth, what he's got. He's letting himself be loved, and you feel it. It just all works. And it's so simple. So if I let myself be loved, everything else happens. We've had some important things. Dick said this the other night, how important it is that you pray. Your words. Those of you who have children, supposing your son is 7 years old, coming home from school, and a 10-year-old beat him up. First time he's ever had anything like this happen. And he's ashamed because he didn't win the fight. He doesn't know what to tell you. He's ashamed because he's been in a fight. And his heart's broken. He's got beat up, and you know, he went home crying, and he's lost respect. Now, supposing he had to come to you and say, Almighty Father, August husband of my mother, he who works, he who presides over our family table, hear the words that I speak to you.
Well, if your kid's got to talk to you that way, either you're sick or he's sick or you're both sick. You wouldn't want him to speak to you that way. Nor does God. What does he want you to say? What's in your heart? Since I've been sober, I have cursed God. And I believe that was the best prayers I could have said that day. And I believe God in his love wanted me to curse him. It was a small little thing. I burned a hole in my best pair of pants. And it was the tail end of a tremendously difficult, hurtful time in my life when very old scars were reopened. I was 3 years sober. This was the end of my cloud nine when things started going down. The bishop had hurt me, and I was driving from Oklahoma City to Lawton, stopped to make a rest drop in Chickasha, got out of the car, and my pants stuck. And I looked down, and the butt of the flame had fallen down, and it was like one of these new acrylic things, and it burned a hole this big. And I looked up at him, and I really let him have it. I mean, I cursed him aloud. And I think that was tremendous, because there was anger in here, and I got it out. And when that anger was out, now there was emptiness, and love could come in. If I didn't express that anger, if I wasn't free to curse God, that anger would have stayed in here, and I could never, ever have gotten it out. If you really believe there's a God, then that's where the buck stops. And any time there's pain in your life, you're mad at him eventually, if you're going to be honest. And tell him. He can take it. You know, your kids get mad at you. I hope if you've got good relations with them, it'll hurt you, but you want them to get it out, and then maybe they can get out of their system. Now it's on the table, and you and they can talk. I believe this is the best way to pray. Pray in your words from your heart. If it involves Anglo-Saxon, use Anglo-Saxon. Say what's there. That's your part of the conversation. You're lying otherwise. There's one requirement for our program to work, honesty. You know, if you're damn mad at God and you say, bless you, that's dishonest and you're not going to feel full love. He wants to love you. He's free to be who he is. Why can't you be free to be who you are? It isn't a good relationship if you can't be. I do this. I do it often. I'll scream, I'll yell, I'll throw things. I haven't hit them yet. And I always feel better for doing it. God, as I understand him, as I shared with you, God, as I understand him, has come to me through you. The only way I'm ever going to understand him is by looking at you. I don't understand him completely, but I understand love. I can feel what you want for me, and I like that. It's so different from what I had been taught. You're not judging me. You're not condemning me. You're not keeping a record of my wrongs. And you're God's power to save me. So God isn't a bookkeeper. You know, I've never, when I've walked into an AA group, been confronted with a record of what I've done wrong. I've never been judged and told, none of you want to send me to hell. And I don't want to send any of you to hell. And I've reached the tremendous insight. Somewhere in the last year, I started preaching this. We would revolutionize Christianity if we would just let God be as big as we are. You know, so many Christians are going to have God sending you to hell because you may call him Sam instead of Jesus. If you come up to me and you call me anything in love, I don't correct you. Some AAs do, but that's their problem. You want to talk to me, my name isn't important. I certainly, even if it is, I'm not going to send you to hell because you got the wrong name. Why would God? People who talk that, they don't know where he is. They've got someone so much smaller than they are. You wouldn't send your